12 shillings, Ryder Courtney insisted. There can be no misunderstanding. 12 shillings, the word of an officer and a gentleman. That description might be debated, Ryder grunted. Will you not carry a weapon?
Yes.
Ryder hefted the heavy ironwood club.
I meant a sidearm or an edged weapon,
Penrod touched the sabre in its scabbard on his belt.
In the dark it will not be easy to tell friend from foe. I prefer denting heads with a fist or a club, not so irrevocable.
They were stepping out shoulder to shoulder along one of the sordid alleys of the native quarter of the city. They both wore dark clothing. The sun had set little more than an hour ago, but it was already dark. Just enough daylight lingered for them to pick their way along. Bakshit was waiting for them near the Ivory Tower, one of the more notorious brothels of the most dangerous section of the city. He whistled softly to attract their attention, then beckoned them into the ruins of a building that had been destroyed by a dervish cannon from across the river. The three found seats on the piles of masonry and shattered roof beams. The intermittent glow of Penrod's cigar shed just enough light for them to make out each other's features.
"Has Aswat arrived yet?" Ryder asked in Arabic.
"Yes," replied Bakshit. "He came an hour ago at sunset."
"Who's he?" asked Penrod. "Who is responsible for this business?"
"I can't be certain yet. Bakshit has heard his men call him Aswat, but he wears a mask to keep his face well hidden. Nevertheless, I have my suspicions. We will know for sure before the night is out."
Ryder turned back to Bakshit.
"How many men with him?"
"I counted 26. That includes 6 armed guards. They will work late tonight. They always do. There is a lot of Dara, and the sacks are heavy to move about. Aswad divides them into 2 gangs of about 12 men each. When the curfew falls and the streets are deserted, they carry the sacks to the customers in other parts of the city. 2 of Aswat's armed men who know the password of the night go ahead of each gang to make sure the road is clear of patrols. 2 others bring up the rear to make sure they are not followed. Aswat waits at the tannery. It seems he won't take a chance on the street."
"How many sacks does Aswat distribute every evening?" Ryder asked.
"About 120.
"So by now he has sold a few thousand," Ryder calculated. "Probably less than 3,000 left in his store. Do you know what he is charging for a sack?"
"At first it was 5. But he has raised it to 10 Egyptian pounds. He takes only gold, no notes," Bakshit told him.
Ryder shook his head.
"Chinese Gordon is getting another bargain. The going rate is 10 pounds. He is offering me but 12 shillings reward."
"I'll cry for you tomorrow," Penrod promised.
"Where is Aswat storing the stolen grain?"
"At the end of the street," Bakshit explained. "He is using an abandoned tannery."
"Who have you left to watch the building?" Penrod asked Bakshit.
"Your man, Yakob. He is Jalan, the most treacherous of all tribes. Even that slithering of snakes have driven him out from their nest. I do not trust Yakob at all. He has no sense of honour, especially with women," said Bakshit bitterly.
It was well known that he and Yakob were rivals for the favours of the widow Nazira.
"But he is a good man in a fight, is he not?" Penrod defended Yakob. Bakshit shrugged. "Yes, if you do not turn your back on him. He is waiting behind the tannery on the canal bank. My men are hidden in the courtyard of the Ivory Tower. The mistress of the house is a good friend."
"She should be," Ryder murmured dryly. "You are one of her best customers."
Bakshit ignored such a fatuous remark. "I chose this place to wait because from these windows we will be able to watch onto the alley."
He nodded at the empty window openings. The glazing had been blown out by the shell blasts, and the frames had been stolen for firewood.
"It is the only way to reach the tannery."
"Good," Ryder said. 2 of your best men must follow the gangs. I want the names of all the merchants dealing with him. As soon as we have them, we shall drop in on Effendi Aswat at the tannery." At that moment they heard the muffled tramp of feet. Bakshit slipped out through a shell hole in the rear wall to carry out Ryder's orders. Penrod stubbed out his cigar and wrapped the butt in his handkerchief, then joined Ryder at the empty window. They stayed well back in the shadows, so they were not spotted from the alley. A group of dark, furtive figures moved past the window. The two guards were first. They wore khaki Egyptian uniform with a flowerpot fez. They carried their rifles, bayonets fixed, slung over the shoulder. The porters followed them, bowed under the heavy dara sacks. The two armed men of the rearguard followed a short distance behind. When they had disappeared, Penrod remarked, "Now I understand why you would not allow me to bring any of the garrison troops, and why you insisted that we use only your Arabs. Gordon's Egyptians are in this up to their necks."
"Deeper than their necks," Ryder corrected him. Within a short time, the unburdened porters and their escorts came hurrying back down the alley towards the tannery.
Bakshit appeared again, with the suddenness of the genie from the lamp. "Ali Muhammad Akrani, who has a house behind the hospital, has bought all 24 sacks of the first delivery," he reported.
They waited for the next delivery to pass the windows.
It was after midnight before the heavily laden porters left the tannery for the sixth time and staggered down the alley.
"That will be the last delivery," Bakshit told Ryder. "In God's name, it is time at last to catch the jackal while he is still gobbling up the chickens."
"In God's name," Ryder agreed. When they slipped out of the rear of the shelled building, Bakshit's band was waiting for them in the shadows of the rear wall, armed with broadswords and spears. None carried firearms. Ryder led them quietly down the alley, keeping close to the dark buildings on each side. The silhouette of the tannery rose against the star-bright desert sky. It was a three-storied building, dark and derelict, that blocked the end of the alleyway.
"Very well. Captain Ballantyne, I think it's time for you to go and find your man Jakob."
While they waited in the ruined building, they had discussed the last details of the raid, so now there was no hesitation or misunderstanding. They had agreed that, as this was Ryder's affair, he would make the decisions and give the orders. However, Jakob was Penrod's man and would take orders only from him. Penrod touched Ryder's shoulder in acknowledgement and moved quickly to the enclosing wall of the tannery's yard. The gate was closed and locked, but Penrod sheathed his sabre and jumped up to grab a handhold in a crack in the masonry. He pulled himself up with a single lithe movement, swung his legs over the top of the wall, and dropped out of sight. Ryder gave him a few minutes to get clear, then led Bakshit and the rest of the party to the high gate. He knew the layout of the building. Before the siege, he had sent almost all of the hides he brought up from Equatoria to be processed by the old German who had owned the factory. The tanner had fled Khartoum with the first exodus of refugees. Ryder knew that the gate led into the loading yard. He tried it, but found it locked from the inside. It was unpainted, dry, and cracked. He drew out his knife, whose point sank into the wood as though it were cheese.
"Huh, dry rot," he grunted.
He ran the blade through the narrow gap between the edge of the door and the jamb, and located the staple of the lock on the far side. He backed off a few paces, lined up, then stepped forward and slammed the flat of his right boot into the door. The screws that held the lock on the far side were ripped from the rotten wood, and the gate swung open.
"Quickly now, follow me."
Across the yard there was a raised loading platform with the main doors of the warehouse leading off it. This was where he had unloaded his bundles of raw hides for curing, and where he had collected the finished product. A broken-down wagon still stood against the platform. The entire place stank of half-cured leather. The glimmer of lamplight showed through slits in the boarded-over ground-floor windows and beneath the main doors to the warehouse. Ryder ran up the steps of the loading platform. Rats scurried into their holes as he crossed to the main door. He paused to listen and heard muffled voices through the woodwork. Gently, he put his weight on the door, which eased open an inch, and peered through the gap. A man was leaning against the door frame with his back turned to Ryder. He wore the long, dark cassock of a Coptic Christian priest, and the hood covered his head. Now he turned quickly and stared at Ryder with astonishment in his eyes.
"Ah, Effendi Aswat,"
Ryder greeted him, as he lifted the ironwood club.
"Do you have any dara for sale?" He swung the club with the power of his wide shoulders behind it, aiming it at the cloaked head. It should have cracked on the priest's skull, but the downstroke crashed into the top frame of the door above Ryder's head with a force that numbed his wrist. The club flew from his grip and struck the cloaked figure a glancing blow on the shoulder that sent him reeling backwards with a howl of pain. "To arms! Stand to arms! The enemy is on us!" the priest shouted, as he raced away across the open floor of the warehouse. Ryder wasted a few moments retrieving the club from where it had rolled against the wall. As he straightened, he glanced around the cavernous warehouse. It was lit by a dozen or more oil lamps hanging from the railing of the catwalk that ran round the high walls just below the roof beams. In the dim light he saw that Bakshit had underestimated the strength of the opposition. At least 20 other men were scattered around the warehouse. Some were slaves, naked except for turbans and loincloths, but others wore the khaki uniforms and red fez of the Egyptian garrison troops. All had frozen in the attitude in which the priest's cry had caught them. The slaves were stacking mountainous heaps of sacks in the centre of the warehouse, and the flowery smell of ripe durra blended with the ancient reek of rawhide and tannin. An Egyptian lieutenant and 3 or 4 non-commissioned officers were overseeing their efforts. It took them all some moments to gather their wits. They stared aghast at Ryder as he advanced on them, brandishing his club. Then, with warlike shouts, Bakshit and his Arabs burst in through the main doors. The Egyptian non-commissioned officers came to life and rushed to where their rifles were stacked against the far wall. Their lieutenant pulled his revolver from its holster and loosed off a shot before Bakshit and his gang were upon them, swinging swords and thrusting spears. The shouting, hacking, cursing melee surged back and forth across the warehouse floor. One of the slaves threw himself at Ryder's feet and clung to his knees, screaming for mercy. Impatiently, Ryder tried to kick him away, but he clung like a monkey to a fruit tree. At the far end of the long building, Aswat was getting away. With the robes of his cassock billowing behind him, he jumped over a pile of loose durra sacks and darted to the foot of one of the vertical steel ladders that led up to the overhead catwalk. As he started to climb, his skirts flapped around his legs, hampering his movements. Despite this handicap, he climbed with agility. All the while, he kept up cries of encouragement and exhortation to his men. "Kill them! Let none escape! Kill them all!" Ryder tapped the clinging slave across the temple with the club, and he released his grip and crumpled to the floor. Ryder jumped over his inert body and ran to the foot of the ladder. He stuffed the club under his belt and leapt onto the first rungs, following the priest and gaining on him rapidly. He saw that beneath the skirts of his cassock the figure wore polished riding boots and spurs, and that his legs were clad in khaki riding breeches. The priest reached the catwalk and clung to the handrail, heaving for breath. He peered back down the ladder. His voice shrilled with panic when he saw Ryder coming up fast behind him. "Stop him! Shoot him down like a dog!" But his men were too occupied with their own problems to take any notice. He struggled with the skirts of his cassock, trying to hoist them high enough to reach the sidearm that bulged on his hip, but he could not free it. Now Ryder was almost on him, and Aswat abandoned the effort. Instead, he snatched one of the oil lamps that hung from the handrail. He lifted it high over his head. "Stop! In God's name, I warn you, I will burn you alive!" The hood of the cassock fell off to reveal the khaki tunic of the Egyptian army, with the epaulettes and scarlet tabs of a major on the shoulders. His curls were dark and wavy, lustrous with pomade. Ryder caught a whiff of a pungent eau de cologne. "Major Farouk! What a pleasant surprise," Ryder said cheerfully. Al-Farouk's expression was frantic. "I warned you!" he screamed. With both hands he hurled the lamp at Ryder, who flattened himself against the rungs of the ladder. As the lamp flew past his shoulder, it spun a meteor's tail of burning oil through the air behind it. It struck the steel ladder near the bottom and exploded, spraying a sheet of fire over the closest stack of durra sacks. Rivulets of flickering blue flames poured over the tinder-dry sacks, which caught swiftly and burned as brightly as candles. "Don't come near me!" Al-Farouk yelled down at Ryder. "I warn you, don't!" He grabbed the second lamp off its hook, but Ryder was ready for it and pulled the club from his belt. The major threw with all his strength, sobbing with the effort as the lamp left his hand. It flew straight towards Ryder's face. He watched it coming, and at the last moment swatted it aside. It spun down into the body of the warehouse and burst over another stack of Dara. The grain went up in a leaping conflagration. Al-Farouk turned to run, but Ryder threw himself up the last few feet and seized him by the ankle. He squealed and tried to kick himself free, but Ryder held him easily and hauled him towards the edge of the catwalk. Al-Farouk grabbed onto the handrail and clung to it, squealing like a pig being dragged to slaughter. At that moment, a pistol bullet fired from below grazed Ryder's shoulder and struck the steel ladder 6 inches in front of his eyes. It left a bright smear of lead on the steel. The sting of the passing shot was so intense and unexpected that he slackened his grip on Al-Farouk's ankle. Al-Farouk felt him give and kick backwards. The rowel of the spur on his other riding boot ripped across Ryder's temple and knocked him off balance. Ryder let go of the man's leg and grabbed at the ladder rung before his eyes. Al-Farouk pounded away along the catwalk. Another shot from the tannery floor hissed past Ryder's head and kicked a slab of plaster and cement dust from higher up the wall. He glanced down in time to see the Egyptian guards who had escorted the last delivery of grain run back into the warehouse. He realized they must have seen the flames and heard the gunfire. They were blazing away wildly, stabbing with bayonet and sword at Bakhshit's men. The one who had fired at Ryder reloaded his carbine, then swung up the stubby barrel and took deliberate aim at him. Helpless, Ryder watched the flash of the muzzle blast and the swirling bouquet of black powder smoke. Another bullet clanged on the steel footplate inches above his head. It galvanized him, and he hauled himself up the last few feet onto the catwalk. He jumped to his feet and raced after Al-Farouk. The Egyptian had disappeared through the low door at the far end of the catwalk. Ryder reached the opening, expecting another bullet from the marksman below, but when he glanced down, he saw the trooper flopping about on the concrete floor like a fresh-caught catfish on the bottom of the boat. Bakhshit was standing over him, with one foot on his throat, trying to pull the buried spearhead out of his chest. Just then, one of the enemy charged at him. Bakhshit gave one last heave, the spear came free, and he levelled it at his new assailant. Ryder saw that his own men on the floor below were heavily outnumbered, and although they were fighting like gladiators, they were gradually being overwhelmed. He was on the point of letting Al-Farouk escape and turning back to join them, when another two men ran into the warehouse through a rear door. "More power to the glorious tenth!" Ryder roared as he recognized Penrod Ballantyne and Jakob with him, dagger in hand. Penrod parried the bayonet thrust that the Egyptian lieutenant levelled at his face, then caught him with the riposte, sabering him cleanly through the throat. The silver blade parted the lieutenant's vertebra and was blurred with pink blood as it came out through the back of his neck. Penrod recovered his blade smoothly, and the Egyptian fell to the ground. His heels drummed spasmodically on the concrete as he went into his death throes. Penrod had a moment to wave casually at Ryder, who pointed through the door at the end of the catwalk. "It's El-Farouk!" he yelled at Penrod. "He went that way! Try to cut him off!" That was all he had time for, and he did not know if Penrod had heard, let alone understood. The flames were roaring like a mighty waterfall, and the entire contents of the warehouse were burning furiously, flames racing up the dry timber beams that supported the walls and roof. "So much for my reward," Ryder thought bitterly. Coughing in the smoke, he ran on after Al-Farouk. He reached the low door at the end of the catwalk, through which the man had disappeared, and stuck his head through it. He sucked in a deep breath of sweet night air, and through streaming eyes saw that beneath him another ladder ran down the rear wall of the tannery to the towpath of the canal. Al-Farouk was still struggling with the folds of his cassock on the bottom rungs of the ladder, but when he saw Ryder's head, he let go and dropped the last 6 feet to land on his hands and knees. He scrambled up unhurt and looked up at Ryder. "Go back!" he shouted. "Don't try to stop me!" He tried again to hoist the tangled skirts of his cassock, and succeeded in reaching the holster on his belt. He drew the revolver and aimed it at Ryder. The light of the flames through the rear windows of the tannery lit the towpath brightly. Ryder saw that the major's hand was shaking. Oily drops of sweat ran down his cheeks and dripped from his double chins. He fired two quick shots, which struck the wall on each side of the door.
Ryder ducked back inside and heard Al-Farouk's footsteps running away along the towpath.
If he reaches the alley, he might get away, Ryder thought, as he clambered out of the door and swung onto the top rungs of the escape ladder.
He went down it swiftly, dropped the last 10 feet, and landed with such force that he bit his tongue. He spat out the blood and saw that Al-Farouk had a lead on him of at least 100 yards. He had almost reached the corner of the building. Still carrying his club, Ryder raced after him, but Al-Farouk dodged round the corner and was gone. Seconds later, Ryder reached it and saw he was halfway down the alley, moving with amazing speed for such a portly figure. Ryder launched himself after him. Once Al-Farouk reached the end of the alley, he would disappear into the tangled maze of streets beyond.
He'll not wait for us to catch him. He'll clear out of Khartoum tonight, Ryder thought grimly.
By dawn, he'll be across the river and converted into the Mahdi's most faithful disciple. What mischief he can do us over there! He was starting to gain on him, but not fast enough, he thought. As Al-Farouk reached the end of the alley, an elegant figure stepped out of a dark doorway and kicked his back foot across the other. Al-Farouk crashed to earth with a force that drove the air from his lungs. However, he wriggled forward on his plump belly and tried to reach the revolver that had flown from his hand as he went down. But as his fingers closed over the butt, Penrod stamped hard on his wrist, pinning his hand. Ryder came up, stooped over him, and cracked him across the back of the skull with the club. Al-Farouk's face dropped, and he snored into the filth of the alley floor.
"A perfect flying trip," Ryder said to Penrod with admiration. "Doubtless perfected on the rugger fields of Eton."
"Not Eton, but Harrow, my dear fellow. And don't confuse the two," Penrod corrected him. Then, as Jacob appeared at his side, he changed easily into Arabic. "Tie him up and tidy and tight. Gordon Pasha will be interested to talk to him."
"Perhaps he will allow me to watch the execution," Jacob asked hopefully, as he unbuckled Al-Farouk's belt and used it to strap his arms behind his back.
"Gentle Jacob," said Penrod, "I have no doubt that he will prepare a place for you in the very front row of the entertainment."
By now the sky and the rooftops of the city were brightly lit by the blazing tannery. They left Al-Farouk to Jacob and ran back to the main gate. The heat of the flames was so intense that the combatants were being driven out of the building into the open. As they emerged from the doors or jumped from the windows, Bakhshit and his Arabs were waiting for them. There were pugnacious shouts and bellows, the clash of blades and a few shots, but gradually most of the renegade Egyptian garrison troops were rounded up. A few managed to escape into the alleys, but Jacob went after them. Dawn was breaking as the survivors were marched in clanking chains up to the gates of Mukran Fort. General Gordon watched their arrival from the battlements and sent for Penrod. His benign expression turned to cold fury when he learnt of the destruction of 3,000 sacks of his precious durra.
"You let a civilian take command of the raid?" he demanded of Penrod, and his blue eyes blazed. "Courtney, the trader and black marketeer, a shabby fellow without a patriotic scruple or a shred of social conscience?
I beg your pardon, General, but Courtney was every bit as committed to the recovery of the missing grain as we were. In fact, his agents discovered where it was hidden," Penrod pointed out mildly.
"His commitment went as far as 12 shillings a sack, and not a penny further. If you had taken command, this fiasco might well have been avoided."
Gordon stood on tiptoe to glare at him. Penrod stood rigidly to attention, and with an effort kept his mouth grimly shut. With an obvious effort, Gordon regained his equanimity.
"Well, at least you were able to apprehend the ringleader. I am not at all surprised to find that it was Major Al-Farouk. I am going to make an example of him to stiffen the remainder of the garrison. I am going to have him and his accomplices shot from the mouth of a cannon."
Penrod blinked. This was a particularly savage military punishment, reserved for the most outrageous crimes. As far as he knew, it had last been performed on the captured sepoys after the suppression of the mutiny in India almost 30 years ago.
"I would shed no tears if that scoundrel Courtney were to share the same fate."
The little general stamped to the window of his headquarters and scowled across the river at the enemy lines.
However, I don't suppose I can do that to an Englishman, he growled. More's the pity. But I'll decide on something that will leave him in no doubt of my true estimate of his conduct and his moral worth. It will have to be something that affects the contents of his purse. That is where he keeps his conscience.
Penrod knew that by far his best policy was silence.
The good Lord knows I cherish no great affection for Ryder Courtney, he thought. No doubt we will soon be at daggers drawn over the favours of a young lady of our mutual acquaintance, yet it is difficult to suppress a sneaking admiration for the fellow's brains and courage.
Gordon turned back from the window and pulled his gold hunter from his pocket by its chain.
8 o'clock. I want this rogue Al-Farouk and his minions tried, sentenced, and ready for execution by 5 this afternoon. I want it done in public, on the Maidan, to make the deepest impression on the populace. I cannot abide black marketeering in the city, where most of the populace is starving. You are in charge, Ballantyne, and I want it done properly.